Do you ever struggle with finding the right words to say? And I'm not just talking about trying to remember things that you're supposed to remember, because that's a whole other category. But to come up with the right words at the right time to the right person. You know, it's really important in interpersonal relationships with parents, children, spouse, friends, employer. Coming up with the right words. Because we want to be accurate. We want to be clear. We want to be understood most of the time. There are a few times when we want to be ambiguous. And then we are. But our desire is to get our thought to become their thought. How do you do that? That's the challenge that we have. There are many obstacles to clear communication. Matters of language, culture, history. Those of us who have had the privilege of going to Russia have observed all of that. The challenge of trying to communicate with somebody who speaks a different language. They know a few words, we know a few words, but not enough unless we've got an interpreter to help us through that incredible process. There are physiological obstacles. Eh? Yeah, didn't quite hear that. Anybody have that issue? Yeah, distractions, a lot of different things going on. I mean, that's all part of the picture. Then there are psychological factors, personality, mood. Ooh, there's a good one. Attitude. Does your attitude affect what you hear? Absolutely. Very much. That's a whole other issue, though. We better not go there too far. Perspective. Worldview. Beliefs. Assumptions. That's part of the equation, isn't it? In communication. Have you ever tried to talk to somebody who had a totally different worldview than you had? And you can say something that you think makes perfect sense, and it, like, doesn't get there at all. Because they're seeing the world in a different way. And so we deal with that all the time, don't we? And then there are interpretive factors, just dealing with the rules of assigning meaning, which is a whole nother study. And, of course, this area today has suffered a great deal of damage for a number of reasons. Because many people assume that nothing can really be known at all. And so then you have problems. So it's amazing we communicate at all, isn't it? When you start looking, it's like, wow, how do we get anything across? Well, sometimes we have to work at it. But we should never underestimate the importance of words or language. Or meaning, but we often do. We're not always as careful as we could or should be. All of this is crucial in dealing with one another. In our interpersonal communication, all of these things are important. They're crucial. But isn't it even more important in dealing with receiving a word from God? Don't we have to deal with all of those things? If God is the God of the universe and He has spoken, don't we want to accurately handle His word, the truth that comes to us? There are many areas where we have failed to do that historically, and there have been many consequences as a result. But there are many areas of confusion regarding the meaning of words. And of course, we know word meanings change over time. That doesn't help. One word which has been misunderstood and misapplied is faith. And we are fortunate to be dealing with a chapter that is loaded with the concept of faith. So we're going to come at it from a few different angles and hopefully kind of cover some of the details there. But today we're sort of just easing into it and looking at some things sort of as a prelude to the matter of faith and then kind of starting to deal with it a little bit. But one of the things that we observe, and we'll mention this more than once, and that is that faith is crucial to all of life, both for now as well as for the hereafter. We cannot function in life without some form of faith. Think for a moment. We have faith that tomorrow will come. And so we plan. If you have no assurance that tomorrow is coming, well, then why bother? But we think it is. We think we have good reason. But is it absolutely certain? In some senses, no, you have faith because you might not be here. Tomorrow might not be here. You don't have any guarantees. So you live by faith. You have faith that people will do what they say they're going to do. To some degree. Sometimes, maybe not so much. But that's trust. And that's faith. And that's what relationships are built on. So it's kind of important. And you live your life with that reality. We also have faith that the water supply is safe to drink. And I have heard about an occasion when my wife's sister was in the Philippines doing missionary service there, where the authorities had received money for providing and caring for the water supply, but they used the money for something else. And it caused some real problems for people because they didn't take care of the water the way they should have. So we have faith that our water supply, and you name any other area, and it's the same way. We live by faith. We would like to have faith that politicians will do what they say they will do and not lie to us. But that's another issue as well. Faith is also a critical part of the argument of the book of Hebrews. The readers of the book of Hebrews, the initial readers plus us, are called upon to be faithful, to have enduring faith no matter what comes. You recall we looked in the previous chapter, Hebrews 10, verse 22, says, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. There was a call to have full assurance of faith, to draw near in that. That sounds like an ongoing thing. And then 10:38 quotes from Habakkuk 2:4, the just shall live by faith, also quoted other places. And then chapter 11, of course, is the faith chapter of the Bible, and it deals specifically with faith, and it deals with the relationship of faith to endurance, and of course includes a number of examples on how believers may patiently endure by faith. And it's basically looking back to say, this is what they did. This is what you can do in light of that. So it's kind of important. So let's take a look at Hebrews chapter 10 and just sort of ease into the context to kind of get a grid for our thinking here. Hebrews 10:35. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. We're going to see confidence has something to do with faith. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise for yet a little while. And he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. And then we begin chapter 11. Now faith says, basically, well, now that I bring up faith, I think I'm going to expand on that a little bit, and that's exactly what he's going to do. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. So, there's a lot there in many respects. So, before focusing on the matter of faith itself, I want to take a little bit of time and deal with some matters that hopefully will give us a broader context for thinking about faith, for understanding faith, particularly in our culture today. And so, I want to begin by dealing with the matter of discrimination. I want us to review the meaning of discrimination. And everything you see or hear today says just like the symbol there, no discrimination. It's bad, 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 bad. Right? Well, let's think about that. The contemporary use. The common view today is that any discrimination is bad. The assumption is that no one should discriminate under any circumstances. Of course, this has been derived from a context of diversity and pluralism, dealing with issues such as racism and age discrimination and disability discrimination, and then you throw into just about anything else you want to think about, like sexual preference and all of that. There's another word that starts with a P that might be better used with that designation. And then it has spread by assumption that it should apply universally, that no discrimination is good. The problem is that this is a serious oversimplification at best. It's no more correct than saying that because cars kill people, they should be banned. Follow the logic. It's a category mistake. It's a hijacking of a term, and that's what has occurred. And it has implications. So let's think about the basic meaning. The basic meaning, I like what this little guy says up here. I don't know if you can read it. The more I think, the more confused I get. That's kind of where our world is today. Discrimination, by one definition, is the ability or power to see or make fine distinctions. Discernment. Oh, well, discernment doesn't sound so bad. The ability to make fine distinctions, that doesn't sound so bad. But there are different uses. According to the dictionary, there's one use that's in the realm of sociology, and this is the one that gets all the press, unfair treatment of a person or racial group or minority, action based on prejudice. That's a real issue. That's something that needs to be dealt with, but that's only one of the definitions. And I would have put that last, not first. But it was listed first. Also, another definition is subtle appreciation in matters of taste. One has discriminating taste. That's not a bad thing. It can be a good thing. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of ice cream in the world. But there are some that are just really, really good. And if you want to know about them, I'll tell you afterward. The ability to see fine distinctions and differences. Discrimination is necessary in all of life. And so we need to take that into account and realize that this word has been hijacked, and be careful, because discrimination is necessary. We are called on to discriminate or distinguish between good and evil, right and wrong, helpful and problematic. And if you throw out any kind of discrimination, then what are you left with? The real issue is the need to define the proper criteria for discriminating. There is a context where it has validity, and that's appropriate. But be careful. Again, it's a matter of misusing, misunderstanding, misapplying a word. And so a word and its meaning are important. We need to understand that. So we need to consider all of those things in light of that. Some practical implications. This is the reality. Every law discriminates. It tells you what is right and what is wrong, what is legal, what is illegal. It distinguishes. That's what a law does. It discriminates. The biggest culprit of all, God. God decisively discriminates. He determines right from wrong, legal from illegal, rules of behavior, and the rules of ultimate destiny. That is very clearly discriminatory. It's very discriminating. It doesn't get any more than that. So we should properly discriminate. We must make judgments based on proper criteria. And so the bottom line is we necessarily discriminate by the choices we make and the beliefs we hold. So that's giving us a little bit of context for if we're going to be talking about faith, we need to realize, oh, it does fit in the larger picture of life. Now here's another one. Consider the possibility of neutrality. The basic meaning of neutral. Well, if you drive an automobile, you know there's a place in there where it's neutral. Well, you either have the shifter on the column or on the floor, and they vary now, but there's an N on there. That stands for neutral. What does that mean? It means that the power is not connected from the engine to the drivetrain, to the wheels. So your vehicle's not going to go anywhere. So that's one of the, but that's not the thing that we're going to be talking about. Neutral is an adjective or a noun, and just some of the basic definitions, not taking part in either side of a dispute or a quarrel, at least not formally, not taking part in a war, not contributing, giving aid, being involved in the process, belonging to neither extreme in type, kind, color, form. You've heard of neutral colors. There are lots of other areas where that's the case, some examples. In biology, there is the neutering of an animal so that it's neither male nor female in terms of its ability to procreate. In the chemical realm, neither being acid or alkaline. Or in electricity, neither negative nor positive, being uncharged. But the basic idea that we're thinking about is belonging to neither side in a controversy, on neutral ground. The common contexts of neutrality. This one we're familiar with. And there should be a particular country that comes to mind. Switzerland basically says, we don't want to get involved in anybody's fight. Just leave us alone. And there's a time for that. There might also be a time when you might need to step out and defend your situation. But that's one of the areas, the common one. Is anyone really politically neutral? Formally, maybe. It may be one's formal position for practical purposes, but really? Probably not. Avoiding taking sides in a discussion. That's the intellectual element. That's the area that we have more concern with. And it has to do with any topic, but I'm thinking particularly of the debate between the proponents of evolutionary science and the proponents of biblical creationism. Because the proponents of evolutionary science say, or at least they try to suggest, that they start out neutral. And then they look at the facts and come to conclusions. And they say that the believer in biblical creationism is biased at the outset. I want to suggest that is not so. That is definitely not so. They do not start off in neutral. They start off with a bias. They start off with assumptions, very clearly. So is neutrality really possible? I don't think so. Maybe in a few contexts where you can formally put yourself in that position because you have the option to formally do so. But in reality, I think we gravitate toward one side or another. The invalid application of neutrality. Just a couple of contexts to think about. Is history neutral? And I'm talking about the recorded history. If you've ever read any history, every history, it of necessity has to take a stand on something because there's too much stuff that has happened over the time, so you have to be selective. The process of being selective involves choosing something and not choosing something else, and that which you choose is going to reflect a particular position. So it is of necessity biased, and that's just the way it is. Whether you're talking about ancient history, American history, Chinese history, Japanese history, Brazilian history, world history of any sort, it's still the case. Well, is science neutral? All science is based on assumptions, is it not? One assumption is that there is an orderly universe. Where did they get that? Who told them that there was an orderly universe based on natural law? Then there's a question, is there such a thing as natural law? Well, that's an assumption, and it's a particular use of terminology. They assume observational accuracy. Now, how much do you trust your senses? I mean, you don't have to look very far, and you can find various brain teaser kinds of things that will show you that your perception is faulty. And so we don't have absolute certainty that our observational ability is completely accurate. And it's certainly limited. I mean, we know just in the realm of dealing with either sound or light, it has parameters in terms of what our ability is able to perceive. And then it goes beyond that. And so you need other instruments to be able to gauge that. What about the rules of logic? Where do those come from? Who came up with logic? What about mathematical consistency? Where do those come from? These are derived from a biblical worldview. They are borrowed. But one of the main tenets of secular science is that all that is came into being by chance. And then you've just thrown out everything else. Or you import it from somewhere else and you borrow it. And that's exactly what's going on. And so they are assuming that what the biblical worldview puts forth is valid, and they're using that, and then they're throwing in this chance origin grid and trying to make it work. Well, then let's throw out another one. Is the Bible neutral? Not at all. It's based on assumptions. It assumes there is a God. In contrast, modern secular science assumes there is no God. Two entirely different starting points. Both build their views on assumptions. Both rely on some form of faith that their assumptions are correct. There is no neutrality. There are no other options, only shades of attempts at neutrality. There are those. There are shades of attempts. So both secular science and the Bible discriminate on the basis of their opposite assumptions. They choose some things, not others. And we have to realize that there is actually no discrepancy between true science and the Bible if you have consistent and valid assumptions. Now, that's a statement I'm going to throw out. I'm not going to defend it right now, but just to recognize that that is the case. If nothing and no one is neutral, that is completely unbiased, then everyone relies on faith based on basic assumptions. Everyone starts with assumptions. No one is neutral. Therefore, it is important that we properly understand what faith is and how it applies to life. So we want to understand the nature of faith. Is this picture with the guy dangling on the edge of a cliff an accurate view of faith? It's like, I'm just going to jump with a leap of faith and hope for the best. I don't think so. The practical meaning of faith. Faith is commonly viewed as simply the opposite of fact. You have on the one hand facts, and then you have beliefs or faith, and they are substandard. They're not equivalent. They're not even in the same ballpark. But then we need to ask, okay, what is a fact? By what criteria do we decide that something is a fact, as opposed to a belief? And is faith a means of knowing? The common view is that faith is a lower level of knowing, if it is a level of knowing at all. And how is faith related to fact? Well, hold that thought. Faith could be viewed as a functional bridge to the facts when all the pieces are not present, accessible, or known. Now think about that for a moment. Faith could be viewed as a functional bridge to the facts when all the pieces are not present, accessible, or known. Now, when are all the pieces present? When are all the pieces accessible? When are all the pieces known to us? Never. Because we're limited. Well, that means that we are always relying on faith to put the pieces together to some degree or another. Doesn't it? because we consistently lack all the facts on nearly everything imaginable, and so we must bridge the gap with faith. Our limited knowledge and our limited perspective requires that we live by faith. The Christian does, the secular scientist does, the atheist does, everyone does. The question is whether we have enough facts and the proper basis for making the step from the pieces to the full picture. Let me try an illustration. There are some of you who are puzzlers. That's probably not the right term, but people who like to put puzzles together. Imagine having a puzzle with various pieces missing. Our minds have the ability to fill in the places. Not completely, not maybe necessarily to our satisfaction, but if you ever put together a puzzle and you found one piece missing, now, depending on how obsessive compulsive you are, that could drive you crazy. It's like, oh, I gotta have that last piece. But it's really amazing that our minds are able to put it together if we have some of the pieces. And we do that by faith, by trust that we have enough to get a good picture. Now, I've seen just recently an exercise where there was a paragraph that was written, and every word was misspelled. And it had the right letters, but they were in the wrong order except the first and the last letter of every word. And I found you could read it just fine, because your brain can put it together. It's a similar kind of phenomenon. So, keep that thought in mind. We're going to come back to that in a minute. The formal meaning of faith, according to the Merriam-Webster dictionary, a few different things. One focuses on the idea of being faithful. This is the definition, allegiance to duty or a person, or the idea of loyalty. Another is fidelity to one's promises, as in, you know, you take it on good faith, or sincerity of intentions, being faithful to your word. Then focusing on the idea of trust. Another definition is belief and trust in and loyalty to God, talking about personal faith. That's more of a formal definition. Belief in the traditional doctrines of a religion. Or another one is firm belief in something for which there is no proof. That sometimes is taken to the extreme to say that faith is simply believing something when you have no basis for it. But how many times do you believe something when there is no basis for it? You believe something because you think there is a basis for it. And another definition is complete trust. Well, so is it possible to have complete trust in something if you don't have all of the pieces? And what did we just say? We never, ever, ever have all of the pieces. So we are always putting things together based on what we have to work with. So that's important to keep in mind. The objective of the author of Hebrews was not to define faith. He was applying faith. In the process, he kind of touches on the edges of defining faith and assumes that we understand what it means. So faith can be a reasonable means of knowing, because that is how we live. Every aspect of life is part of that equation. Susan just got on an airplane on Friday by faith that it was going to take her to where she wanted to go and not land in a mountainside somewhere, as some planes have been known to do. Believe me. Let's see, that's using that word. Faith is involved in every area of life. But faith is also tempered by reason. If you saw fuel spilling out of an airplane while you were sitting on it, how long would you stay on that airplane without getting an answer for why is there fuel spilling out of this airplane? And so on. So there's reason involved. Well, let's review the passage we're looking at again here. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, putting together the pieces of a puzzle. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. Let's try to break this down in some workable structure. Faith is required for the anticipation of future events. We've already alluded to that in planning for tomorrow. And that's kind of what it's saying here. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, the anticipation of something future. This describes the application of faith more than defining it, though there's some element that comes through, as we've noted. Various contexts require the application of faith. This is, of course, true in all personal relationships. There's a practical need for reasonable confidence that someone is trustworthy, that something is true. There needs to be some basis for it. That means you have to have some of the pieces of the equation to be able to put it together. Faith is assurance that something is true, that someone is trustworthy. We recognize we don't have absolute guarantees because of our limitations on our level. But what about God? Is God on our level? Do we have anything that tells us that when we think about God, we should think about God as being on the same plane that we're on? Never. God is not on the same plane. He is the creator of the universe. He is a different type of entity than we are. We are created things. He is the creator. We're totally different. And we have to keep that distinction in mind. Therefore, God can be completely trustworthy because he's in a different category than we are. So there is room for us to have a greater level of certainty regarding his word. We're still limited, so I have a hesitation to say that I can have absolute certainty that God is true, that God's word is true. I can try to say that, but I still am limited. So I'm hesitant to say that I can really get away with doing that because I am not absolutely anything other than a sinner. And that I can say. But otherwise, I have to keep that distinction in mind. Can anyone be absolutely certain that evolution is true? Not a chance. Or a host of other theories that are out there. We're all in the same boat of having to settle for reasonable certainty with this matter of faith being part of the equation. The conclusion is that faith is a matter of assurance. We have a measure of assurance based on certain things. And I'm going to skip down just a little bit and move on to the next one, because we've got a whole lot more chapters to deal with faith. So we'll touch on some of the other details. Faith is evident in the lives of people of the past. That's what the next section says. The rest of chapter 11 essentially expands on what verse 2 says. When it's talking about the elders, it's a reference to the various ancestors of the past, includes key figures of the past. These Old Testament saints are referred to as a great cloud of witnesses in chapter 12. And you have to understand chapter 12 in light of chapter 11, because otherwise you're going to come to a faulty conclusion on what that is dealing with. And the emphasis is on their exercise of faith in a variety of different contexts and different ways, the different experiences that they had, and the faith that they had in living that out. And the point is that faith is exercised by these saints, which is a testimony of God's grace in their lives and of their ongoing dependent trust in Him. And the emphasis is because they trusted in the midst of some incredible circumstances, we ought to trust God in the midst of incredible circumstances as well. Faith is required for analysis of past events. That's verse 3. And verse 3 had to do with understanding the worlds, or the eons, the times of the past, but worlds is a workable expansion of that idea, that were framed by the Word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of the things which are visible. So when we come to wanting to evaluate things of the past, what do we do? What do we rely on? How many of you have ever wished that you could come up with a time machine so that you could go back in time and check it out for yourself and see what really did happen back there? That's why I like the movie Time Bandits, because they would go back in time. Of course, they were trying to steal things from the past, so there was a sinister element to it. But I like the idea of thinking about time in that way of thinking. But the past events are not observable. Only by records, only by the things that are recorded that tell us about it, do we know of what happened back there. I mean, we can look at the phenomenon of the present, and we can try to extrapolate and make assumptions, which is what happens, but do we have the right grid for doing that? The author of Hebrews is saying that we have a reliable record for knowing about origins. That's what essentially it's communicating. Other pagan records are perversions of the biblical record. And when you look at it in that way, it just jumps right out at you. That's so obvious. But everybody turns it around and they say, well, you can't believe the Bible because that's got too much supernatural stuff and we can't buy that. So it has to be that the pagans had, you know, they had the stuff out there first and then the Bible just copied it. No, it's the other way around. The Bible had it first and the pagans perverted it. I mean, that's just reasonable. When you look at the specifics, it's like, well, that makes more sense. Science lacks the means of effectively analyzing the past. We have to remember that evolution is a theory. And it's a belief system that is based on certain assumptions. And so they then have to work from their assumptions to analyze the data. And they come to faulty conclusions because they can't get back there and they won't take the record that we have. And that's kind of interesting. Their presuppositions limit their acceptance of available records. We have a record of the creation of the world. We have a record of history that goes back to that point. But they won't accept it. Now, they will accept the ancient Greek writers, which have very limited and far less quality manuscript evidence than what we have for the Bible. They'll accept the weaker manuscripts, but they won't accept the stronger evidence that we have. So one's presuppositions make all the difference in the world. And there's faith in that process. So evolution is an unsubstantiated belief system. And the testimony of Hebrews 11:3 is that the past ages came into ages or worlds came into being simply by God's spoken word. And there's other scripture, of course, that collaborates with that. Genesis 1, John 1, a host of other places that brings that out. So any view of the past must ultimately be taken by faith in the records available and by the objective analysis of the available data. And of course, that's the key right there, objective analysis within our presuppositional basis, starting point. Is anyone totally objective? No. The practical implications of faith. Faith is an essential part of life. We must use some form of faith in everyday living. We cannot function in life without faith. There are different levels and contexts of faith that are commonly used, and so we want to be sure that we are not afraid of faith as if it were something second-rate or something spooky. It's like, ooh, faith. It's not real. Well, faith is real. Faith is that which puts the pieces together that makes sense of all the different pieces. And we have to come back to that reality. So faith is an essential part of life, and we must recognize that faith is not a simple concept. It is not just relegated to the realm of religious speculation, as some would suggest. It is much bigger, much broader, and then it has a lot of different parts and aspects to it. And we will be looking at some of those in the weeks to come as we go through chapter 11. Looking at the different aspects of faith and how it relates to the Christian, to the believer, and how it relates to our salvation, and how it relates to my daily living, and what is the relationship between those. But the bottom line for the present is that we need to continue to trust God, to believe Him in all the messy details of life, that we need to simply take Him at His word. Let me just conclude with a simple picture of faith. At an ocean beach, a young child was lying on a tube in the water. Eventually, she started drifting out to sea. Her father began swimming to try to catch the drifting tube and child, but unfortunately she had drifted out of reach. So he shouted to her to just keep still, that he's going to come and get her. So the father went back to shore because he was closer to getting back to shore than he was to getting out to reach her. So the father went back to shore and jumped in a boat with a friend, and they went out after her. When they reached her, they found her there, floating, playing with her fingers, just sort of chilling on the tube in the middle of the ocean. Well, not the middle, kind of working her way out there. And so she was asked, "Why did you stay so cool and so calm?" She answered, "Well, it's because I had faith that my father would come for me, as he said." That's a pretty good picture of the idea of faith as it relates to the Christian context. because she had a basis for it. Well, she had seen how her father had worked in the past and how his word was valid. So it was just a logical step. He said he's going to come and get me. Well, I can just relax and realize that even though I see a disconnect because he's going the other way, he's going to come back because he said he would. So there is an element of confident assurance that's part of the picture. When there is a dependable object or person, that is the basis of the faith, and we have good reason to trust our Heavenly Father.